This is part two of our carnivore conversation. Last week we talked quite a bit about our own experiences getting into carnivore in the first place, around a year for yourself and maybe a little bit longer for me, but more of an on-off thing where I've been through various different phases, tried out different iterations. Last week, you weren't feeling 100%. I think you had a little bit of a cold, and I'm assuming that is due to the chronic lack of vitamin C in your diet for the last year.
Maybe, who knows? Yeah, I had a cold. I've had it actually this last few weeks. I've had this just ongoing on-off cold. Now, but for several months prior to that, I hadn't really had anything, maybe one or two. What I've noticed is that I'm getting my colds when I'm really overexerting physically. So I'm entering squash tournaments, or I'm playing 6 7 days on the trot plus coaching, and I'm sort of pushing that envelope. But what I have noticed as well is that I'm going through the stages of colds much, much quicker than I had done before. So typically, a few years ago, if I had a cold, it would be guaranteed go to the nose, go to the chest, and it'd be 3 4 weeks. Probably had to go to antibiotics to get rid of the chest infection. Now, I'm finding that that's not the case, and I'm going through the cycles much, much quicker. Plus, I'm actually doing way more physically than I have been doing previously. And I think a part of it is just my not knowing where the stop switch is when I'm doing stuff. The vitamin C thing's interesting because my mum is trying to ram vitamin C down me. And to be fair, I have taken some this time, along with I do a lot of inhaling with old bass oil and taking old bass pastilles, but I've always done that. But I did go, like I say, for several months without any sort of issue with that. And that includes going through beginning the school term. I teach kids in squash coaching. So, and you're typically, exposed to loads of different back to school cold viruses and stuff like that. So I'm not, yeah, I'm, I don't know. I don't know what you've read about it, but the little bit I have read suggests that there's something about glucose and vitamin C competing for the same receptors or some sort of transport gate or somewhere on the cell, and that for people who are having a very low carbohydrate diet, that actually you need far less vitamin C than you w would if you were on a high carbohydrate diet. And that maybe also ties in with vitamin C being an antioxidant and high carb diet creating a lot of oxidative damage as well. So yeah, I vitamin C may play a role. I don't know enough about it. What have you come across anything in particular?
My understanding is probably similar to yours, that on a lower carb diet, there's less of a requirement for vitamin C. I haven't felt any negative effect from a potentially lower amount of vitamin C for quite a lot prolonged period. How many
Haven't had
teeth
scurvy yet.
have you lost from the scurvy? I think I've still got all of mine, so yeah, I haven't noticed any adverse effects in terms of colds or anything like that, really. Perhaps slightly different, but along the same lines, is I did have for a long time like a low level sinus irritation. So I'd be sniffy, a bit like the symptoms of a cold. And certain foods seem to like create more mucus as well. So when I'm on a stricter carnivore diet, those two things go away completely.
That's
So
interesting.
I haven't totally narrowed it down, but there's something in my regular diet, I think, that has those effects, those sort of cold-like effects, though it's not exactly a cold, but similar, irritating the same areas. But yeah, when I'm on a strict carnivore diet, I don't feel like that at all. So that's the only parallel that I can draw, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting those I watched a YouTube video from Lily Kane, who she's this dead quirky person who sort of she doesn't advocate as she's not like a strict carnivore, but she does base her diet around that. And this was a really honest video about what she does do and what she doesn't do, and all the abuse she got from the strict carnivore people about, oh, you have this, you have that, you're not carnivore, you shouldn't call it that, this, that, and the other. And she talked about all the different side effects. She's done quite extensive experimentation. But I think a key point to come out of both of what you've said, some of the things we talked about last week, some of the things that might happen, we'll talk about this week, is that we have an awful lot of symptoms. Most people have some form of minor irritation or whatever going on in their life almost every day, whether it's from simple bloating of the stomach, which I used to think was perfectly normal, to your itchy nose. Lily Kane talked about itchy scalp. It's that and the other, skin conditions, eczema, psoriasis, acne, all of these types of things. And there's a whole idea of like, well, okay, how do you narrow it down? Do an elimination diet. And when I sort of like, with the carnivore diet, it seems to be the simplest, most effective elimination diet because in pure, certainly if you, for the majority of people, if you're just talking pure meat and water, there's very little that has an allergic reaction or there's little known allergies. Egg whites, I think, quite well known, crustaceans, seafood and stuff like that. But if you went pure meat and water, you're pretty much ruling out any allergens whatsoever. And then you could introduce stuff in after that.
Yeah, I think something that we forget about in the modern world is that everything's available to us all year round. And I banged the drum about this a bit last time. So maybe it's fine to eat certain fruits, certain vegetables at particular times of the year, but having them constantly all the year round, perhaps that's creating a situation where you're getting a buildup of something in your system that is more than your system can tolerate. So you could think about spinach, perhaps. So spinach is an example that a lot of people be aware of. Contains oxalates, which, if consumed in excess, can lead to kidney stones. So this is something that people have known about for a long, long time. In the past, you'd probably consume spinach at certain times of year, and then it was gone. You certainly wouldn't have been having raw spinach in a smoothie every day, all year round. So I think this is partly where we go wrong. And I'm certainly not making the case that we should never eat fruit and vegetables. I don't think that is the case. But it's perhaps just taking a step back and thinking about what we're doing and thinking a generation or two further back, how would things have been then?
No, I agree totally. Like you say, we used to have a cookbook called it was Seasonal Cooking or Good Seasons Cookbook, something like that. And it was all about what you could eat in your region, eat all year round. I think that is very, very important. The other thing you mentioned, spinach, oxalates, that type of thing. If you Google anti-nutrients, the primary sources of things that cause irritations, anti-nutrients being nutrients that reduce the absorption of minerals, vitamins, etc., maybe cause some sort of irritation, etc. The primary sources are all basically vegetables, nuts, legumes, seeds. And there's something called like a FODMAP diet. I haven't really looked into it, but I know, there's a lot of people who have to follow this because of irritations. And again, it's primarily like sources of plant-based foods that they're cutting out. And I know that this all flies in the face of what we've been traditionally told about vegetables and plant foods, etc. But the more I read into it and the more I look into it, the more suggestion I come across that maybe we do need to be a little bit more careful on the plant food side of thing and not go with this assumption that, yeah, eat your vegetables because they're good for you. Yeah, plant foods in nature, we can't just go into nature and eat whatever we want from a plant's point of view. So that, yeah, that was quite intriguing. This was especially weird for me after having gone vegetarian because of the thought that that would help my cancer. A little note to that, but what I've read about traditional societies and stuff, ones that have been primarily meat-based, plant foods do seem to have a long history of medicinal use, which is again, so like yourself, I wouldn't necessarily rule it out and stuff, but are they optimal? And maybe there's a context for when we should be having them as well. As well as you say, the seasonal thing, I think, is massive.
It's so easy to fall into the trap of these massive generalizations, these broad statements. So there's definitely a narrative around at the moment about plant-based, and the assumption with that, or the association with that, is that plants must be good for your health. And it's very alluring, I think, to have these simple solutions. If I eat more plants, it's going to be good for me. But this is just such a sort of simplistic way of looking at things. I hear people talking about cutting out carbs because carbs are bad. Again, that's a huge generalization. A fruit, a grain, a processed carb, these are all vastly different from each other. Yes, they all break down to pretty much the same thing in your bloodstream, but how quickly they do that, the other things that they come along with, ignoring all of that is a massive oversimplification. And we can't do the same now with just plants on one side and animal foods on the other. It's just getting ridiculous to simplify this much. So talking about all plants as though any plant is good for you, regardless of context, is kind of ridiculous. One plant in particular which causes a lot of emotional reaction with people, I think it's emotional reaction, is because it's such a favorite, is the good old coffee bean. So what have your experiences been on a plant almost plant-free diet with this one anomaly that most people will find hard to quit?
I have a fun relationship with coffee, as many people with a diagnosis of ADHD or even people who don't have that diagnosis but probably behave in that way, they'll often use caffeine to sort of self-regulate their mood, their focus, their attention. So I've had that, I've ever since I went to university, I got piled into coffee, big time. Discovered the addictive effects and the withdrawal effects of severe headaches, etc. Have tried to give up on occasion, and I did so successfully during lockdown, where I basically used circadian rhythms and timing, getting out early in the day and stuff, and got to the stage where I didn't need coffee at all, which was fantastic. I do like it though. I like it. To me, it's like a holiday thing. Go and sit in a coffee shop. It's very much like a social thing where I like meeting friends. On carnivore, I think basically on the back of Dr. Anthony Chaffee, who's a big advocate of just pure meat and water. He said he noticed very, very noticeably the effects of caffeine. And I don't know whether it's almost placebo effect from having heard that interview, noticing it, but I did actually cut out caffeine for probably, I don't know, 2, 3 months, last summer, and it was great. Energy, mood, Fantastic. I sort of came off it gradually. I would start off with 3 teaspoons of caffeinated filter coffee and then add in like soy leaf, titrate it down with decaf ground coffee. And so coming off wasn't an issue. And I think maybe because daylight was there, etc., I was getting out early in the morning. So I was able to make use of sort of the daylight's effect on our hormones, cortisol, etc., to have that good attention and good focus. And I didn't miss it at all. As soon as I get a little bit stressed, or I set myself a deadline. So I got back into coffee September when I had my exams for my level 3 squash coaching qualification, and immediately I had assignments to do. And I don't know whether it was just habit memory, but I felt the need for caffeine. And yes, it certainly helped, seemed to help with my focus and sitting down and stuff like that. But then at the time, I was also really quite ramping up my squash. And what I noticed was that for several weeks of this, I was actually getting quite severe cramps the next day, typically in my feet or my calves or my shin muscles. And that would be the next morning. Nothing much during the daytime or whatever, but it'd be the morning after. Would manage to cut out caffeine again for a while. And again, the cramps went. Did a little bit more research, and apparently caffeine potentially stops our absorption or strips magnesium from us. And magnesium's like can act as a muscle relaxant. So I dabbled with supplementing magnesium, but I don't really want to take supplements. One, I don't really trust the supplement companies as such, because again, it's just you, I don't know what's going in these little white pills. They all look the same to me. So I'd rather not take supplements if I can avoid it. Now I've got back onto pretty much pure meat and water again, seafood, having a few little odds and sods, but I'm having 2 mouthfuls, 2 pieces of dark chocolate each day. And it was only when you've asked that I've made the connection. I haven't actually had cramping from having coffee, and I am drinking quite a lot of coffee at the moment. So, and there's something in my memory tells me that there's reasonable magnesium levels in dark chocolate. I'll need to maybe double check that. So I don't know whether that's a form of supplementation that I, non-carnivore, plant food again, toxins, who knows? But it actually, the dark chocolate, just as an aside, I've gone into because of I was trying to get off the Greek yogurt and honey. And the dark chocolate works quite well for that for me, is like I just have that maybe that little craving for sweetness. So yeah, that's my experience. I like coffee, but I like being off coffee as well. Although it's harder to be off coffee than it is to stay caffeine free at the moment. What about yourself?
I don't really like the effects of coffee. So personally, I don't feel like I need caffeine for an energy boost. I think I exist in a state of being kind of a little bit wired anyway. I'm very rarely short of energy. So I don't need something that's going to push me over the edge and send me manic. I have had more caffeine in the past before training. Sometimes it'd be good. What I do like about it really is the ritual. I was really into coffee for a long time. I was into the proof coffee thing for a while. That's putting butter in coffee. I was obsessed with that. I would carry some butter and a blender with me wherever I went, so I could have, at the appointed time, have my bulletproof coffee. And it's not just the effect of caffeine for me, it's the whole ritual. As you said, coffee shops as well, it's a nice little treat, indulgence, little break in the day that you can have. So that's the part of it that I like more. So I'll still have like a decent decaf coffee in a decent coffee shop from time to time. But as for caffeinated coffee, always feel afterwards like I wish I hadn't had it. And sometimes even with decaf as well, it just feels like I've put something a little bit nasty into my body. And I just
Okay.
want to drink a lot of water and get it out of my system. So yeah, it's an occasional indulgence for me. I'm not convinced about these things that you read on health blogs and magazines and people talking about coffee as a health food. I think it's a stimulant. Some people have some confirmation bias there. You know, they find it really hard to give up. They don't want to give it up. So they find
Totally.
reasons why it might have some benefit. It's got some polyphenols or something like that. But you know, they tried to sell cigarettes to us as being good for us at one point. And yeah, you can argue nicotine perhaps has some benefits.
Focus again. Nicotine is like been touted for that, yeah.
So I don't really buy the caffeine as a health food thing.
No, and I think and this is a theme that crops up a lot when we look at things like fiber, vitamin C, caffeine, I probably think as well, is these have all been shown to be beneficial in some way, shape, or form. I think predominantly against a standard Western industrialized diet. And I would be interested to see what the benefits of those things were against a primarily animal-based ketogenic diet and see whether they have the same benefits as they do against our standard Western diet.
I think as well, anything that can be classified as a drug, which it is, you know, caffeine's a mild drug, isn't it, really? You can argue there's a benefit in that you get some focus and alertness, maybe some vasodilation in the brain or something along those lines. But then there's a rebound, isn't there? It dehydrates you slightly. So anything that it gives you, there's a rebound where there's a, you fall back from that baseline afterwards, so you need another one.
I think it's interesting what you say about hydration because I definitely do better when I drink adequate water alongside it. And that just does seem to balance it out again. The other thing, you mentioned your bulletproof coffees. So like Ray Peet, and who's very much an anti-stress physiologist, minimize stress at a cellular level where you can, sees coffee as a stimulant. So if you are going to have it with milk or sugar or something like that to actually negate that. Almost that stimulant effect and that extreme stress response to it. And I do notice that I will sometimes go black coffee and fasting through the day. But I will definitely feel more wired. I will get cold hands, cold fingers, which typically a sign of a stress response. Whereas sometimes I will do butter coffee, maybe with a teaspoon of honey in as well. And that's a nicer experience. And I tend not to get as wired or as cold, and that seems to work better for me.
Well, I think the butter is slowing down the release of the caffeine into your system, so you get probably a smoother energy increase, perhaps like a smoother drop off as well. And I'm not a big sweet person really in terms of adding sugar to things, but
You're a lucky sod you are.
A coffee with sugar seems to make me less jittery than a coffee without. I'm not exactly sure why, but yeah, I think it does seem to just smooth things out a little bit. I think you could be right. It's just giving you that extra little bit of energy alongside it.
Well, Ray Peet talks about it, caffeine stimulates our basically our fight or flight or our stress-based nervous system. And he also talks about fat and sugar being physiological stress relievers, which sort of makes intuitive sense when we talk about comfort foods and stuff like that. We turn to sort of sugary, fatty foods for that exact reason. And so it's almost like you're balancing it out as you have it. The other interesting drink related to that is maybe something like green tea. Which has caffeine in it, but it comes with theanine in as well, which again seems to balance out this stress, anti-stress response sort of thing. So people can drink more green tea without getting, they can get that the focus benefits of the caffeine, but not necessarily get the same stress response. Again, I'm not, I think like yourself, anything that's labeled as a drug or whatever, there's a an upside and a downside to it. And when I was able to live in sync with my circadian rhythms and get adequate daylight during the day, and especially in the morning, then actually I had no need for any of that stuff, and my mood was great throughout the day. And so I think, things like daylight, I know it's difficult in the modern world, and this is one of the issues we have, but there's certainly ways to mitigate the need for things like caffeine, etc.
So butter and honey in the coffee seems to be the message here if you're going to have a coffee.
It's interesting. We'll move on later on, I think, to mental health, and there's a couple of articles from Dr. Georgia Reed, who's a nutritional psychiatrist, I think she calls herself. Is it her? Oh no, there's maybe a different woman. So I might be getting mixed up, but someone talks about what is coffee good or not. She doesn't like it, but it's because it's a stimulant. But she does say it's a good vehicle for adding fat into your diet through the butter, which I thought was quite interesting. Yeah, it's not Georgia Reed, it's somebody else. Elizabeth Bright, I think, is the one
Oh,
who said that. Yeah.
Well, as we've got moved towards this subject of mental health, how do you feel that the carnivore diet has affected you? You've mentioned ADHD a couple of times. You've mentioned emotional reactivity. What's been your experience there?
So, absolutely massive, I'll say. First off, it's really opened up my eyes to a whole host of possibilities, and sometimes like, oh my God, what if I'd found this stuff out earlier in my life? I have a diagnosis of ADHD, and what comes along with that, which is recognized for a lot of people, one of the symptoms or signs is emotional reactivity. Maybe people are oversensitive, over emotional, react, lose their rag quickly, that type of thing, which can happen to everybody. And we know that, if you're tired, etc. So to put it in context, a year ago, two months before I started carnivore, my mum and dad moved up to Newcastle. I've been trying to get them up for a few years. They moved in, and I worked late, and I was coming around every night, and I would need food, and I wanted to cook, but mum didn't. It's a small two-bed apartment, and the living room kitchen is one big room. So if I cooked, it stank the whole place out. And mum really wasn't happy with that. So I went to eating breakfast cereal late at night, because that was the easiest thing I could think of at the time. I mean, two things that were happening in this 2 months prior to me starting carnivore. One is I put on loads of weight, but I was rowing constantly with mum. Absolutely, almost every day we were having some sort of argument. Typically in the mornings were worse. Fast forward a few months, and it comes to Father's Day. I've been carnivore for 2 or 3 months. I think Father's Day was in June, and I started in April. We went out for an Indian. I decided to have an experiment. I just ate whatever, had a couple of gin and tonics, glass of Prosecco, had ice cream. And then the next morning, I ended up having this flaming row with mum. Massive. And it was like, wow. I was watching, and then later on that day, I watched a YouTube video. Dr. Anthony Chaffee was interviewing someone about their experiences with carnivore. And he happened to say on there that he had been much m more mentally calm. And I sort of tried to think back actually. I was like, wow, I was rowing every day with mum, but it hadn't happened for a while. And I asked mum, when was the last time we rowed? Can you remember? And she said, oh, it seems like a while ago. And I said, well, before or after I started carnivore? And she said, oh no, before then. I think since she started. So that was the first sign that, whoa, hang on a sec. How was my diet affecting my mental stability, my emotional reactivity? Straight back onto carnivore. It was just one day off. Fast forward another few months, celebrating a squash win. This is September, October time now. And had a few pints of pizza. Again, just feeling a bit more up and down, irritable. A week later, I went to see a friend, and because I'd wanted to celebrate with a Chinese takeaway, because Chinese takeaways were my favorite food of all time. And I went and got this Chinese takeaway. And it was a bit of a funny night because my friend was having some problems. It was all a bit edgy, stuff like that. So I was maybe a little bit stressed at the time as well. The next morning, again, a massive, massive row with mum and dad. And then later on, a row with someone at work. And I hadn't rowed with anyone at work since I've been there. I don't go near rowing with people at work. My work situation is such that, I'm self-employed, so they can say goodbye to me really, really easily. So I know I need to, keep everything sweet in that sense. So I never ever row at work, and I had this massive row. And I just, the more I think back to how I felt growing up with cereals, with sugars, when, probably the 80s, more processed food was coming in. We had quite a lot of takeaways. How emotionally reactive I was at school, how many fights and bullying situations I got myself into because I was just the one that could be prodded and would bite back. And thinking that that hasn't happened typically since I've been doing carnivore. I started researching mental health and carnivore ketogenic diets and started seeing all of this research out there. Ketogenic diets, I think I was well known for epilepsy already, and I started seeing it across the board for other things. There are some riders in that, but addiction models as well. And this, to me, it makes intuitive sense because of the high low blood sugar that you get eating a standard diet. But on a low carb ketogenic diet, that blood sugar regulation seems much more sensible. That's the way I can explain it for myself. But yeah, a massive, massive difference in terms of how I respond. And I can equate that back to post-cancer as well. And I was on a vegetarian diet, but again, it was low carb, high fat. I was like pretty much green veggies only, and I had loads of fat in the diet. So again, not quite ketogenic, but it was very much based that way. So I do think there's something there in it, which is something I'm looking to explore at the moment. Have you had anything, any
Yeah,
experiences?
kind of similar. I was brought up eating quite a high carb diet. At least 50% of calories, I think, would have been coming from carbs. Maybe as much as 70. Things like breakfast cereal in the morning, sandwich at lunchtime, a meal in the evening that would probably have rice or potatoes or something like that with it. And as a kid, I was constantly hungry, but that continued into my 20s, probably more getting close to my 30s, really. Yeah, into my early 30s, I was still eating a very high carb diet. And I would carry food with me wherever I went. I always had an emergency cereal bar or flapjack or something, on me because every 2 or 3 hours I needed to eat. And if I didn't eat, everything had to come to a halt until I found food. I'd be super irritable. After a certain point, which I attributed to low blood sugar. And yeah, finding a lower carb diet made a huge difference, not needing to eat every 2 or 3 hours. It's ridiculous, you know, it's like being a baby really, where you can't go for more than a couple of hours without having to be fed. So moving on to a higher fat, lower carb diet made a big difference. But in the last couple of years, I've gone much higher fat, sometimes almost zero carb. That seems to have taken things even to another level. So, you know, I didn't become a saint just because I stopped eating carbs. I could still be irritated, I could still be cranky and reactive. But I feel like I notice an improvement, even from just taking the fat levels up a bit higher. I just feel a bit calmer, and things that situations would come up occasionally, and I'd catch myself thinking, I probably would have reacted badly to that a couple of months ago or a year ago, and it's just water off a duck's back. So yeah, I think the higher fat I've gone, the higher in fat I've gone, the more even my mood seems to be, and the less reactive I am. Seems to give me that extra split second to think about what I say before I say it.
And I'd echo that, and I think post cancer, immediately post cancer for me, I was, I think, pretty much very, very calm and happy with the way things were going post treatment, etc. But I wasn't working, and I was doing two lots of 20-minute meditations every day, seeing friends, sitting in the sun, grounding, you know, most days, and so everything was in place for me to be calm. The difference now is that I typically feel those same levels of calmness, but I'm now working. I still try not to work too hard, but you know, I'm still working, you know, 20 to 30 hours a week, traveling around and stuff. I'm not doing anywhere near as much meditation. And well, because of this period that's gone, I've done carnivore. I did it over a summer, but then we've had the winter and stuff, so I haven't been getting much daylight, haven't been doing much grounding because of the it's too cold for me in this weather. So I'm feeling that with that side of things, that yeah, actually the diet has played a massive part, and then adding in those other things makes a big difference. And what you said about the higher fat, I notice what, like, now we talked about eating mince and, you know, stuff like that, and the 20% mince, and I will quite often eat mine raw. I know that's quite freaky for a lot of people, but I actually almost, the moment I have a mouthful of that, I can feel myself mentally coming down, and it's almost like calming in the moment, when I eat that.
That's very interesting. I haven't experimented with the raw carnivore idea yet. Haven't been brave enough yet.
It's a bizarre one. It was, I mean, I'd had steak to tare a while ago, wasn't particularly that keen on it, but steak to tare would typically be made with fillet beef, so pretty much sort of much higher protein, lower fat. And I just dabbled with it because I think in Uncom, was it Jordan Potts and maybe one or two others had mentioned having the raw stuff and the digestibility of it, etc. So I just thought, I'm going to try it. And over time, yeah, the mince and salt is just great. And sometimes I'll crack the raw egg yolk onto it. And it's
Yeah.
just so convenient as well.
It's the ultimate convenience food, isn't it? But I think you mentioned this last time, and you said that something along the lines of your palate will adjust to different things. So for example, I quite often just eat beef mince with salt and thoroughly enjoy it. Now, a while ago, that would have seemed really bland to me. I used to use a lot more flavorings, using garlic and onions and different seasonings and spices. And I thought I'd try, as part of an experiment, to just eliminate all of that stuff. And yeah, at first, salted beef was pretty bland. Salted beef mince was pretty bland. But over a short period of time, the palate adjusts to that. And now I don't really want all of the spices and
Mm.
garlic and things that I used to have before. So I think, you know, our bodies and our minds are quite capable of adjusting to different things. So I don't see why it would be that different adjusting to raw if if you're willing to stick with it for a little while.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, it was just I experimented every now and then. And the first time I tried it, I think I could maybe eat 100, 200 grams, and I felt, ooh. But now I can wolf down 500 grams. And
I know,
like you
I've
said, I
seen
mean,
you
yeah, well, yeah, last time
it.
when I came to see you, yeah, that's exactly what I did. And it's interesting, this idea of, I think we want to air our experiences because we have felt so many benefits around a not necessarily a pure carnivore diet, but an animal-based diet as opposed to a plant-based diet. And I don't know about you, but typically what I get is like, I still get questions, oh, are you still doing the carnivore base? And I am, yeah, pretty much. And they'll say, oh, you're so disciplined, it's so I could never do that. And I probably think a year and a half ago, I probably would have thought exactly the same. And so I wouldn't ever say to anybody, if you are interested in trying it, it's like, just try it and see what happens. But I would say give it at least a month, possibly, a month to 3 months, I would say. And just go with it. You'll need 2 to 4 weeks to adapt, and there will be a couple of weeks where you might not feel so clever on it. But I've got the stage now where, like yourself, the seasonings, every now and then I dabble with Thai sweet chili sauce because I used to go through a bottle of that every 2 days. And now I just actually, the meat and salt, more often than not, I prefer. And I don't want to put the sweet stuff on it. Now, in a world where it's the difficulty in giving up these cravings. We know that certain things are bad for us, but we, the cravings stop us from doing it. For me, I don't get those cravings now. Probably 95% of the time, I'm craving free of sugar. Alcohol's the other big one for me. I used to crave alcohol after a hard squash session, hard fitness session, or anything. Just do not fancy it anymore. Now, there's a flip side to that, social side of things and stuff, but the benefits outside of those times for me have been so much that actually it's not hard to do what I'm doing now. It's not a discipline thing at all. That's what I want. I just want meat. Sometimes I'll have shellfish every now and then. And like I say, I have some dark chocolate. I'll experiment. I'll have ice cream every now and then, but typically regret having it. Or wish I, well, actually, I don't need that again. So, yeah, like you say, you get used to it, and I very much believe that our the gut bacteria will flourish in such a way that they will drive your appetite, and the benefits you get will be, you'll just want to keep doing it if well, I certainly want to. And I know you do too, the way we've talked about it. So, yeah.
I mean, life is short and we should enjoy our food. And I go through phases where I say, okay, I'm going to allow some sweet stuff in. And it's nothing too crazy. Some honey, some fruit, some ice cream occasionally, like your dark chocolate as well. And I'll go through a phase of having that, enjoy it. And then every so often I think, okay, I'm coming to expect this at a certain time every day now. It's become a bit of a habit. So I'll just make myself cut it out for a week or something like that. And then sometimes after a week, I'll find that I don't want it for longer. Again, I think the body just adjusts to what's coming along and that becomes normal very quickly. But in terms of cutting out less healthy choices, it's not been hard at all because I think when you have an adequate amount of protein. I think protein is huge. We've talked a lot about that, but getting an adequate amount of protein, when you've had the amount that your body needs, your appetite just reduces so much. And I think, even for me, as somebody who trained for years and was eating quite a high protein diet, I still don't think I was eating enough protein because I'd have a meal and I'd have an amount of protein that I thought was the right amount based on some rubbish I'd read in books about how much protein you need for protein synthesis. That's, how much you need to recover from an exercise session. So, okay, it's roughly equivalent to one chicken breast or whatever other kind of protein that's in that ballpark of being about that much at a meal. So I'd have my meal with some carbs and some vegetables and decent large piece of protein. And about an hour after, be sneaking into the kitchen, opening the fridge. My stomach's full, but I'm thinking, I want something else. I want something else. And at a certain point, I said, I'm just going to eat as much protein as I want. And on occasion, I've doubled that amount. So get similar to yourself. A pound of protein at a sitting's not unusual once a day. Probably not twice a day, but usually my second portion will be a little smaller. But if I hit that amount of about a pound of protein, and it's with fat, high fat meal, some salt in there, just don't think about food for hours at a time. Just yeah, it's not on my mind unless I'm a bit bored and think, oh, some dark chocolate would be nice at this point, to break up the afternoon or whatever. But certainly not hunger, and it's not really a craving. It's more of a mental thing than a physical thing.
I agree totally with that. They're just I don't yeah don't need to think about food, and so it almost becomes a non-issue. I would so that relates back, because one particular friend was saying, oh, you've got to live life, you've got to have some pleasure in life. And I said, I've become wary of anything that gives me pleasure without effort. And I guess that relates to dopamine. Now, don't want to get too technical here, but dopamine is sort of a like a reward molecule, but it encourages us to do a behavior rather than it's the actual reward itself. And one of the reasons ketogenic diets seem to be recommended for helping with addiction and side of things is that they are far lower, have a far lower dopamine response. So when something gives us dopamine easily, and alcohol, gambling, porn, all these types of things, social media, scrolling, all of this type of stuff, it's too easy to get it. But what dopamine does is encourage the behavior that gives you that spurt of dopamine. Now, food for me was a big thing like that, and alcohol. Whereas actually, if you can go the other way for your dopamine, for your cold showers, your exercise, you're sitting down and focusing on a task or whatever, you get that dopamine, but you've had to go through some sort of struggle to get there. And I think that was the evolutionary design that came about, was for that. But if we get pleasure from food, I think it actually makes it harder to do the other things in life. And it's like pleasure from social media, stuff like that. Your general motivational levels go down. So that's, again, for me, that's been a big realization, through a combination of research in ADHD and all the struggles I've had with that, the various sort of addictive things I might be doing. And food was one of those. So yeah, again, that's the mental health side of things, and but also maybe our performance, mental performance is a big thing there as well. What's your ability to be able to do something? So again, I think there's a deeper exploration of that that's possible, going forward.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way to look at it. So I think ancestrally, most of our time and physical effort for most of our evolution would have gone into the acquiring of food. So there would be an inherent reward in that. We probably might not have been snacking all day on food that was easy to come by. Maybe at certain times of year there's fruit growing and you can grab whatever. But the majority of your food probably would have been a fair bit of work. So that would have been the big reward of the day, maybe a couple of times a day. Less of these micro rewards that we can get through technology all day, which become addictive. And even then, the kind of reward that we would have had from eating natural food is very different from eating something that's ultra processed and has got carbs, sugar, fat, salt, all mixed into one. So not as stimulating on that level, but probably in terms of the satisfaction of the physical labor and effort that went into it, more rewarding on that level.
Definitely. And thinking about like then relating that to the physical effort needed to go into it. I do, whilst we're, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, there's still a lot of interpreting, guessing, etc., and the various, you know, should we be eating all meat or all plants or somewhere in between? We know we can eat everything plant and animal based. But the for me, it seems to make sense that we would there was this period. The Ice Age, we've talked about that potentially about, you know, how Ice Age it was or whatever it is like, but there were definitely animal sources of food that were available there. And one of the things that does separate us from, say, chimpanzees and gorillas and the like is that they need to eat a lot more and graze a lot more than we do. We can go for hours. I mean, if you have a high protein, high fat meal, you can maybe eat once a day, you know. Twice a day is, I think, a fairly common meal frequency for people I've seen on the carnivore diet and talk to. Whereas, as you said, a high carb diet, it's like, oh, you need to balance your blood sugars, and every 2, 3 hours, you're desperate for something to eat. And almost like you say, I mean, hangry, hungry and angry. But that sort of term was a very big part of my life. So. And then I start thinking as well, okay, well, to be able to hunt, we had to be physically capable. And that type of food that we adapted to, I believe, is predominantly meat and fat. And so then that leads me to like, well, how do we reconcile that with the modern world thinking of high carbs are necessary for physical performance? Because there will have been times where high carb was not available. Definitely not, you know, winter in northern hemisphere places, high carbs not available, especially pre-agriculture, etc. So where did our physical performance come from that enabled us to be able to go hunt, build shelter, fight, all of that sort of stuff? So yeah, maybe that's a segue into athletic performance
For sure.
and like low carb stroke carnivore diets.
So when you went on to a carnivore diet, were you previously eating a higher carb diet? See if we can differentiate a little bit, because generally a carnivore diet is going to be a low carb or ketogenic diet. But you could be on a low carb or ketogenic diet that isn't carnivore. So what was your diet like before carnivore in terms of carb intake?
Well, so certainly for the 2 months prior, I think I mentioned I was eating quite a lot of cereal at night with mum and dad and stuff like that. Yeah, it was it, I can't think back exactly, but I would have pasta or rice, stuff like that. I'd gone through phases where I was very much almost more paleo, meat and veg. But certainly immediately prior, the year prior to carnivore, I was just eating anything and everything. And I've managed my weight primarily through circadian timing, of eating meals and stuff like that. And would have takeaway pizzas, Chinese, stuff like that. So yeah, I would say high carb. And yeah, my performance was okay on it. I actually, in March before I started, I won a squash tournament. Although I would say it was a hell of a struggle physically.
In what sense was it a struggle physically?
The trying to get my body moving after each match, the day after, trying to refuel adequately. It would take me 2 hours to prepare for each match. Which was hard. It was painful and stuff like that. And I just think I managed to do it better than the other people in the tournament at the time. It's a graded tournament, so your people of a similar ability are put in. So, yeah, it was interesting. But I had zero endurance. I had like, quick short bursts of speed. But as soon as I went past a 3-4 shot rally, I was an absolute goner. Whereas that has changed now, although it didn't necessarily change for the better for the first few weeks, if not months, I would say. But
What was that adaptation like then?
so, I mean, the two main sports I can like to the very racquetball and squash. I mean, two things. One, I lost weight fairly quickly, so that helped massively. But what I found was that I lost sharpness, massive sharpness. And from everything we know from conventional science up until that time, was that you need for a high intensity exercise, you needed sugars. And any studies that have been done on it showed that as well. Decreases in performance if you went to a low carb, high fat diet. I think the one sport, endurance sports were maybe slightly different because you're going at a much lower intensity for longer, and low carb diets had started being explored in that. And yeah, I definitely found that it took me 6 weeks of playing racquetball to get back to a level prior to starting carnivore. Squash, I would say, took me 5 months, 5 or 6 months. But now I'm playing at a level and a fitness above and beyond where I was. And part of that's the weight, but also part is the fact that I can actually just play more regularly because my body is less sore. I can play more times in a day without it causing as much of an issue. Although I do still think I tend to overdo it, and hence the sort of like, maybe the colds and stuff like that. And I started digging into the research a bit about it, and it seems now that there's a few more studies, or at least a couple of studies that have been done that look at fat oxidation rates and people on very low carbs versus high carbs. And there's some interesting things there that we've seen. Fat oxidation rates as high as 2 grams per minute of fat, even at 85% plus of VO2 max, which typically would be thought there would be almost zero fat being burned. Now, just a bit of quick maths. There's 9 grams of 9 calories per gram of fat. 2 grams, that's 18 calories per minute. S per hour, that's roughly 1,000 calories worth of energy that you can supply through fat burning alone, which actually, I don't know if you put into your run calculators or whatever, how many calories per hour X speed of running takes, it's a decent speed.
You'd be hard pressed to burn 1,000 calories in an hour, I think, with
Yeah.
most forms of exercise.
And so I'd been willing to try this out on the basis of the promises I've been held, and the fact that up until then I've been basically injury ravaged, muscle pulls, more serious stuff, ill every winter, this, that, and the other. And then Chafee and Baker and yeah, those doctors were talking about athletics performance. They were doing interviews with people. There's Ben Patrick, knees over toes guy, who's primarily meat based. He has fruits as well with it. And so I was like, I want all of this and I want less pain. Keegan talked about a couple of conversations I had with him about that it could take several months, if not years, to get full on adaptations. And we see that all the studies that have been done, the longer the adaptation, the higher the fat oxidation capability is, the more sugar preserving that is, carbohydrate preserving or glycogen sparing. So yeah, it holds great promise for me in that sense. And I'm really enjoying the fact that I'm pretty much pain free after maybe even 2, 3 hours of squash now, whereas 45 minutes and I'd be struggling to walk down the stairs. So, and that ties in with my idea of hunter gatherer in the Ice Age. And it's like maybe there's a placebo effect in there, I don't know, but I like the idea that, yeah, actually I can not eat most of the day and still go and have a really good game of squash, which would have been unfathomable a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I don't have quite the same experiment as you because I transition to a lower carb diet gradually. So it's a little bit harder to say. I would say, first of all, my first lower carb diet, I went to having carbs just once a day. And that was usually as part of a meal in the evening after my main training session. And the sport I was doing most of the time then was boxing with some weight training. And with the boxing, I did feel that I was lacking the top gear at first. So it felt like I could only go to sort of 75%, and I was just a bit sluggish. Didn't feel sharp. It was extra effort at first. It's hard to say now exactly, but I think over a longer period of time, somewhere between months and a year, it just gradually went away. I went lower carb. I've been periods where it's almost zero carb. I don't do that kind of training as frequently as I used to, though. So I used to do that kind of training maybe 4 times a week. So boxing training maybe 4 times, weights a couple of times. Now it's more like the other way around for me. So I'll lift more often and do something that's more high intensity cardio less frequently. At this point, I feel absolutely no issue at all on virtually zero carbs. Don't feel like I need to carb up before or after. So it's probably quite a slow, gradual process. If I was doing that sort of high intensity cardio more regularly, would I feel a bit different? I don't know. I haven't really run that experiment. So I think the adaptation period is quite long. But once you get there, I don't see any downside at all so far.
Well, and it's interesting because we assume because we've got zero carbs in the diet that we won't have carbs in the body to fuel that high intensity stuff. And I think there's a two sides to this equation. One, that we can produce more energy rapidly enough through fat burning. So the more mitochondria you have, the more energy you're going to be able to produce. Ketogenic diets have been shown to improve the number of mitochondria. If you carry on doing the training, those mitochondria will adapt, become bigger, more powerful, produce more energy. The studies have shown that the glycogen levels don't really change. So it's not like we have zero glycogen in the muscle. There is always glycogen there. And what seems to have been shown is that glycogen can be replenished during fueling. I was like, well, how does that work? If you're not having carbs in your diet, etc., how does that work? Well, triglycerides, one of the biggest forms of fat storage in our body, it's basically three fatty acid chains attached to a glycerol backbone. And the glycerol is basically a form of sugar. Anyone who has drunk glycerine, it's very sweet. And that can be used to get converted into glucose and glycogen in the body. So actually, from the fat that we're burning, we can produce glycogen along the way as well, or sugar, essentially. So it's not even as if it is a zero carb fueled performance. There is carbs in there, but our body does that from the food and our own internal stores. So yeah, like yourself, now my sharpness, I can sprint multiple times, and do that for quite a while, you know, maybe 10, 15 seconds, and then do that 10, 20, 30 times over with a minute's rest. And that's still that, you know, for me, that's like, well, there's no carbs in my diet to fuel that. So what's doing it? Something's working.
And yeah, how's your squash ranking at this point?
Ah, yes. So, it's just a tiny little bit off my top level ever. So I hit a high a couple of years ago. I dropped over a season in promotion. Actually, I might be able to show you. Let's have a look. But essentially, during a tournament I played at the end of March, very briefly, I hit my highest ranking ever. And I've been doing that since September. I'll see if I can find a, I can get this graph up for you.
This is your highest ranking ever at 57 years young.
Yes, yeah, that is correct. So I'll look, do this over. Over the last 5 years, so this will give a monthly average. So let's see if we can, if I do share
Yeah, and
screen,
share from one of those buttons
the
at the
button,
bottom.
the screen, and then. So this is my squash rankings from the last 5 years. Oh yeah. So you can see over here before prior to 2020, I was down at about 1600. We then had obviously this big period here with no dots. That was COVID. I did a lot of squash coaching then. I had a massive increase there. This was through coaching and speaking with circadian rhythms and stuff like that. Up and down over this time, but now we've seen this was November last year. So I started carnivore probably back here. So 2nd of April 23, started carnivore here. Took a while to get into it, but now we can see that, you know, I'm basically up at my highest ever. So that, you know, for me, that's massive. Yeah, just really enjoying that aspect.
So you're ranking higher and feeling physically better, recovering better
Yeah,
as well.
and dare I say it, I mean, from I think September I did this specific fat reduce cut fat cut protocol, which was based along the protein sparing modified fast or as an uncommon lean countdown diet, and got to the stage where my abs were showing again, and it was quite funny because you go into the, like, you know, you're showering and stuff, and you can just notice people are glancing at you thinking, hang on a sec, what's going on there? I haven't seen anyone's abs in a long time, sort of thing, and so yeah, that was a nice feeling. Not that it's funny because I've always been anti the aesthetic side of that's the reason to do fitness, but actually it's been a really lovely side effect of that, and yeah, it's it just yeah, it's been good physically, I think looks wise as well. Most people generally don't guess my age at 57. So yeah. And I've been through, you know, 8 months of chemotherapy, which was quite ravaging. My oncologist suggested that that should have aged me by about 10 or 15 years. So yeah, there have been some mitigating factors. Well, I say mitigating, there's been some factors which I should look older. I mean, I think, you know, I've been fortunate enough genetically to maybe have that type of thing. I also think there's other factors, collagen in the diet and stuff. I've always eaten loads of chicken skin cartilage and stuff, and I think that has an effect on the skin. But again, where does that come from? Meat-based diet.
Interesting stuff regarding the physical performance. I'm coming up 50 this year,
And again, I think you look pretty good for 50, mate.
Generally feeling not that much different to how I did when I was 25. In some ways fitter, in some ways a little bit less
Yeah.
fit, but that's just a change in how I train. So some things have improved, some things are not as good. But I feel like I could get back anything I did when I was 25. I feel like I could still do that. And I'm sure that the diet has a big effect. It's not the only thing. There's things that you've mentioned about circadian rhythms and
Yeah.
sleep. And I have a lifestyle where I'm a coach, so I'm always in a gym,
Yes.
so I can train at times that convenience me. So that is an advantage that not everybody has if you
Yeah.
have different commitments,
Likewise.
work and family.
Likewise with my squash, exactly the same. I'm coaching squash now, so a big part of that is I can be on court every day and practice and stuff. But I think that the diet has enabled me to be on court able every day as well, because a lot of coaches I know are complaining about knee pain and hip pain and this, that, and the other, and I'm not. So, yeah.
Okay, well, we've been at it for just over an hour. Shall we wrap things
Yep.
up here? I think there are some other things we could talk about in terms of long-term health
Yeah.
implications, which we haven't got into before. That's a big subject in
Yes.
itself. So maybe we save that one for another conversation. Teaser for next time.
Yep, I think that, yeah, that's a good idea. All right. Thanks a lot, mate.
Okay, Mike, great to speak to you.
Cheers.